through fields, perhaps in the wild pear forests in the region of Johol, north of Peking. Meyer agreed, but he had come to resent Fairchild's tone. It was often more nagging than friendly. An earlier Meyer would have let it roll off his back. But he had grown bolder and into a man who urged his boss to put a little less officialness in your letters and a little more warmth, for I am all alone here and am not much in conversation with my fellow men, so one needs a little sympathy in his letters. Fairchild replied that he understood, that he, too, had experienced that loneliness, although Meyer's circumstances amid hostility, mistrust, and extreme weather were undoubtedly worse. One reason Fairchild pushed so hard for his beleaguered explorer to return to the job may have been that Fairchild was pleading for Meyer's sanity as much as for his own. Meyer's slow breakdown was coinciding with a similar collapse of plant introduction, dragged down by Washington drama. Whether to comfort Meyer or himself, Fairchild wrote his explorer a motivational screed in hopes of reminding Meyer what he had signed up for, the job he had loved, and the service to his adopted country, whether anyone thanked him or not. "We have only one life to live, and we want to spend it enriching our own country with the plants of the world which produce good things to eat and to look at," Fairchild wrote. Fairchild insisted to Meyer that if he didn't feel well, he should return to America, but it came across as insincere. Fairchild filled the rest of the letter with plant talk and suggestions for Meyer's route. The harder Fairchild pushed, the deeper Meyer sank. Fairchild requested that Meyer acquire 100 pounds of opium poppy seeds. Securing them would provide an opportunity for American farmers, given China's crackdown on the crop and the threat to behead any farmer growing it. This assignment would require permission from the president of China himself, who Meyer couldn't get to, let alone convince. On this, and Fairchild's other requests, to get 50 kilos of mustard seeds, dozens of samples of pepita citrus, and scores of shade trees for American cities, he began to fall short, hampered by limits on access and his own energy. "The loneliness and the hardships of life here are beginning to be more and more distasteful to me," he wrote Fairchild. This distaste began to manifest into physical symptoms. He experienced digestive trouble, insomnia, and bouts of fever. The immediate cause was his nervous sleeplessness. Between the Civil War in China and the larger war raging in Europe, Meyer's larger problem was the paralyzing effect of this never-ending horrible war. He openly wondered if humanity had hit its peak in 1914, believing that so much fighting had set off the slow collapse of the world. Leaving China and returning to Washington wouldn't have been difficult. Meyer could have caught a steamer down the Yangtze to Shanghai, and then to Hawaii or California, effectively aborting his trip. No one could have blamed him considering the circumstances. Meyer even wrote to Fairchild that he had imagined soon leaving plant collecting to younger men. But for some reason, Meyer couldn't let himself quit. It was an indication that, despite his sorrow, the quest for plant exploration still burned inside him, however dimly. He also pondered the notion of what he might return to in America. He could expect safety in Washington, but the threats of World War couldn't guarantee security anywhere. Instead of following the Yangtze to Shanghai, he decided to go the other way, deeper into central China, in search of wild peaches. 50 pieces of mail were waiting for him when he reached Hankou, a city in central China on the Yangtze River. Many of the missives were from Fairchild and had been delayed months by incessant forwarding. Fairchild seemed oblivious to Meyer's hardships and his mental state. "It is difficult to imagine just what conditions surround you, and I imagine it is more difficult even for you to imagine what changes are taking place here in America," Fairchild wrote Meyer on May 2, 1917. It was. And as several months passed, the chasm between Meyer and Fairchild continued to grow with the distance and time it would take for letters to be delivered. If Meyer was crying for help with his anxiety or state of hopelessness, Fairchild missed the request completely, repeatedly filling letters with botanical suggestions and chatty encouragement. Limits on Meyer's ability to move freely began to fray him. "I tried to write for a few nights and days in succession so as to finish all of this troublesome correspondence. But," he continued, "nature stepped in and I got an attack of nervous prostration and could not sleep, rest, or eat any more." A doctor told Meyer the ailments were caused by overwork, loneliness, and worry. Adding to that was the fact that a man prone to boundless wandering had been given constraints, and that the voices in his head had no escape valve. He began to refer to himself in the third person, feeling removed even from his own body. He observed, "The change from roughing it to sedentary work seems harder and harder to overbridge as a person gets older. If one only could have a congenial fellow white man with one, it would not be so hard on one." The letters piling up only added to Meyer's deepening anxiety. If he had kept moving as he had on his prior expeditions, he could have outrun them. But as he stayed still, they caught him and delivered more requests than he could handle. A millionaire farmer in Beijing wanted his advice. American experiment stations wanted help with crops Meyer had picked up years earlier. One letter in April 1917 broke the dismaying news that the United States had entered the Great War. The news was especially troubling to a man who had grown up with dreams of utopia and harmony. Around this time, when Meyer was running out of hope, he was also short on paper. One evening, in a moment of introspection, one of many, with no one around to talk to and with his anguished mind retreating to a place of darkness, he taped three envelopes together to make a list. He titled it, "Proposed Resignation," and filled it with 10 reasons why he might finally quit. 1. Not feeling as well as formerly, sleeplessness, less energy. 2. Mentally soon tired, not being able to do as much work as formerly. 3. Paralyzing effect of this terrible, everlasting war. 4. Loneliness of life and very few congenial people to associate with. 5. Travel with all this enormous amount of baggage. 6. So much squalor and dirt in China. 7. The destruction of my 1.5 years' work over herbarium material has given me a much deeper blow than I ever admitted. 8. The new plant quarantine laws, the difficulties of shipping. 9. No garden to study the plants one has collected. 10. Assistants have no real interest in this work. All of these factors weighed on him like a ship taking on water. He thought one evening, "Is it strange that a man at times gets very tired? And the more so now, since my adopted country has seen fit to join in with others in this monstrous world war, and we will get our lists of wounded and killed from now on regularly in our lopsided and misinformation-giving daily and other papers." Meyer spent his lonely nights thinking about the war, his days so empty that his thoughts routinely turned macabre. When Fairchild asked him to brainstorm new ways for the United States at war to produce more food, he responded that America might kill all unnecessary animals and put incurable criminals and insane people out of the way. To anyone reading these thoughts on the other side of the world, this seemed highly unlike Meyer. A man who had overcome so many physical evils had been weakened by vague events far from him. People shown Meyer's letters thought they came from a different man. Fairchild again dismissed the gravity of Meyer's deterioration. His response to Meyer, while gentle, reflected an era before depression meant more than a temporary sadness or had a clinical diagnosis as a mental disorder. June 29th, 1917. "We are all much grieved to hear that you have had a nervous breakdown. We can none of us believe but that, with your unusual physique, you will rally from your nervousness and get back on your feet in a short time, providing you could shake off your worries with regard to things to be done, responsibilities that have come as a result of the war, etc. Do not forget that we consider the knowledge which you have accumulated a most valuable asset. You have begun a great work, and it would be a tremendous pity not to carry it further, particularly during these strenuous times. Everyone in the office sends hearty greetings to you and warmest sympathy. I remain, very sincerely yours, David Fairchild, Agricultural Explorer in Charge." The reason for increasing pressure on Meyer was that the war had begun to fill Washington with anxiety across every federal agency. President Wilson increased the war budget, which brought nearly 50,000 new residents into the Capitol, many in automobiles that congested the streets with black clouds and traffic. In August of 1917, a month normally dormant with congressmen fleeing the humidity, the city buzzed with frenetic energy. Few people knew how to help, but everyone bounced around anyway. Attention to the war took top priority. To make room for military planners, the Department of Agriculture moved its offices up the street to an office building with more space, but less light. Meyer, when he received this news, called this a bad piece of business that took the staff further away from plants and the out-of-doors than ever before. Fairchild, however, saw the move as positive, likely because he had no other choice. A new office would shield his work from visitors, at least temporarily, to let him get back to the serious questions of plant introduction work. In truth, however, there wasn't much work to do. Marlet had sown concern about the unknown, but the war brought fear of death and destruction, specifically in anticipation of a German invasion. The media fed these fears. In 1915, a best-selling book, Defenseless America by Hudson Maxim, the man who invented smokeless gunpowder, fictionalized a German attack on the United States. The same year it became a motion picture, which showed Washington laid waste by German bombs. Government posters urged people to buy as many war bonds as they could manage. In April of 1917, the same month Meyer was emotionally breaking down in Yichang, President Wilson ordered the creation of a committee on public information, charged with demonizing the enemy and whipping up patriotic obligations to convince people to fight the war however they could. The Department of Agriculture created its own propaganda, including posters calling people to help harvest corn and to cut waste. Food. Buy it with thought. Cook it with care. Serve just enough. Save what we'll keep. Eat what would spoil. Home grown is best. Don't waste it. Trying to introduce plants amid the flurry of war was like trying to sell petunias in a hurricane. People's interest in new foods, or foods at all, had to do only with whether they were cheaper than before, or whether they lasted longer. No one can adequately describe the confusion of those early days of the war, nor can I look back at them without a shudder, Fairchild later wrote. In the winter between 1917 and 1918, while Fairchild paced around the office considering the latest harebrained schemes to feed American soldiers in Europe, grow more beans, eat cornmeal to preserve flour, Marion started driving an ambulance. She was qualified because she could drive. The woman who had once been forbidden by her father to assist Clara Barton in Cuba now worked for the Women's Red Cross Motor Corps of Washington, taking shifts around the clock. The Fairchild's Maryland estate, meanwhile, became a retreat for peaceful thinking. Woodrow Wilson used the Fairchild's property to escape tightly wound Washington and occasionally brought his Secretary of War, Newton Baker, for frank and classified discussions about the war. While Mrs. Wilson and Mrs. Baker admired the cherry blossom trees, the President and Baker wandered the estate discussing plans for America's entrance into the war, at least until they sat on a bench fastened between two trees. The flimsy board snapped, dropping the two men on the ground. They might have laughed in a different context. Baker later told Fairchild, "I thought for a moment we had been bombed." During all this, Frank Meyer sat alone. His only news came from Fairchild in Washington, and occasionally from his friends in Holland. Fairchild had become too stressed to attend to Meyer's increasingly erratic emotions. He also admitted he didn't know what to say. "You speak in one of your recent letters of wishing you had someone to advise you. My dear Meyer, these are times when we all need advice, but unfortunately, there are times when those who try to advise feel peculiarly incompetent to do so. I might easily advise you to come back to this country and take up the breeding of plants, but I do not feel sure that a man of your restless disposition will be contented with the necessarily quiet life of a plant breeder. I must now stop and take up other pressing duties. Hoping that you are recovering from your temporary indisposition, and with kindest regards, I remain David Fairchild, Agricultural Explorer in Charge." It seemed as if Meyer couldn't deteriorate more, but he did. His interpreter in Hanko, where he stayed amid the ongoing fighting, quit after becoming impatient with the hot climate and the food. "What would become of our social structure if we all did the same?" Meyer asked, utterly frustrated. This incident had been the final test of Meyer's racial tolerance. He wrote to Washington to describe unabashedly how difficult it was to deal with a non-intellectual race. "I have become so callous to opinions of Chinese that it matters but mighty little what they think. The whole race has become too weedy for lack of healthy contact with outside people during all of these past centuries. With the exception of a few, they are quite satisfied with the ways their forefathers did things. Like the West, China was marching further and further into troubling times, with new rebellions that fueled the bands of robbers and outlaws that tormented Meyer. Rebels looted and started fires. Soldiers stormed towns indiscriminately to impose martial law, often shooting machine guns loudly into the ground. Floods from the Yellow and North Rivers washed out fields and displaced people, exacerbating confusion and chaos. Meyer was at particular risk. An outsider could be easily accused of trying to quash the rebellion, or worse, trying to help it. His movement remained slow for the following months. His mood changed with the weather. At times, he'd find the energy to return to spurts of plant hunting, but with a sluggishness, as though wearing cement boots, constantly paranoid and suspicious of his surroundings. He tried to put this sentiment into words for Fairchild. He described how food supplies were running low and fighting raged around the clock. "As I am writing, we hear the rickety noise of rifle fire, for the northern and southern troops are at battle only a mile or so north of the city," he wrote Fairchild. "That we do not live at ease, you can easily imagine." In the Yangtze Valley, a sense of depression hung in the air, which affected Meyer so deeply he began to question his life. "I feel the evening of life slowly descending upon me, and the fearful sorrow which hangs all over the earth does not make life the same it once used to be." Meyer kept receiving letters from Washington, many delivering the dispiriting news that his earlier seeds had arrived in poor condition, or worse, not at all. Fairchild checked in with him periodically. Mail service was already slow, but the war made it even slower, delaying letters up to 3 months by the time they'd reached China and chased Meyer from inn to inn. In March of 1918, nearly a year after Meyer's nervous breakdown, Fairchild wrote him a long letter about plants. Its length revealed as much about Fairchild's esteem of Meyer as it did about Fairchild's loosening grip on his own work. He closed it with a tender sentiment shared between two men whose worlds had been shaken beyond recognition. "Do not become despondent in any case, for regardless of the fearful sorrows and the horrible features of the life which is around us, we must push on to bigger and grander things before life really closes in on us." In the heat of war, and amid his ongoing collapse, Meyer summoned the strength for one more bout of collecting, the resulting crops his final contributions to his adopted country. Near Xingshangxian, he came across a ginkgo biloba tree with edible seeds that Americans would later find useful for boosting brain function and treating high blood pressure. A few days later, he filled his trunk, one last time, with Yichang lemons, a hearty type of citrus from the region where citrons and pepitas originated. He sent them to Swingle, who was back in Washington studying how to make citrus hybrids stronger for farmers, shippers, and eaters. Once that was finished, Meyer entered a tailspin. Sleeping went from difficult to impossible. Revolution filled every street with looting and burning. Soldiers fired guns into crowds. When the bullets killed people, Meyer watched as the soldiers mutilated the corpses, digging out the hearts and passing them around for bites of courage. His inns, which began to host the dirtiest people lacking any place else to seek refuge, were filled with lice so thick he could see them scurrying across the sheets. "China is surely in a sad plight now," was all that he concluded, as anyone might have. "Oriental character and republicanism do not seem to agree." On Thursday, May 30th, 1918, Frank Meyer fell asleep with a pain in his stomach. He had been vomiting for 2 weeks. His journals revealed that he dreamed of his friends in Holland, who had once urged him to immigrate to America to find its glowing spark of prosperity. He had lost weight and could hardly keep food down, and when a servant boy asked if he was okay, he lied and said he was fine. He and the servant boy boarded a boat, the SS Fengyang Maru, bound from Hong Kong to Shanghai, where his ordeal would finally end. Meyer paid for a cabin in Chinese first class, a cheaper alternative to foreign first class, to save the government money. He shuffled around the boat for 2 days, drinking tea and eating porridge and murmuring to himself. Just after midnight on Sunday, June 2nd, 1918, Meyer left his cabin and wandered to the ship's railing, looking into the dark Yangtze below. He wore a white undershirt, gray trousers, and yellow shoes. There were no suspicious people on board, no one with a motive to attack a sickly foreigner on a luxury boat. just a despondent man who held little hope for a fractured world. The next day, a man near where the boat had passed found Meyer's body. It was black with dirt. He brought it to a local hospital. While everyone stood around staring at the lifeless creature, the man who found the corpse asked if he could keep Meyer's shoes. A telegram reached Shanghai, which relayed the news to Washington. Someone at the State Department who had followed Meyer's adventures responded that the man who had given America so much deserved a dignified burial. Samuel Sokobin, an American consular official, hurried to the village and paid a pair of Chinese men to help dig up Meyer's body, which, in keeping with local custom, had been buried in a shallow pile of mud on the banks of the Yangtze. Sokobin put Meyer in a coffin to be taken to Shanghai. He wondered if Meyer might be Jewish and would want a Jewish burial. He wondered if Meyer's father in Holland wanted to bury his son, or if the Department of Agriculture wanted its prized explorer to be honored in Washington. But, lacking evidence for any of these possibilities, and with a decomposing body on his hands, he buried Meyer in a Protestant cemetery in Shanghai. When it came time to prepare his headstone, the consul in Shanghai summed up Meyer as best he could. In the glorious luxuriance of the 100 plants, he takes delight. Several weeks later, Meyer's final letter arrived in Washington. Hundreds of Meyer's letters had been delivered to the Department of Agriculture, but this time, the envelope seemed like an artifact. "It often seems that we do not live ourselves any longer, but that we are being lived," he wrote. The closing salvo of the letter and of his life diagnosed the world with stirring accuracy that would be forever relevant. "Times certainly are sad and mad, and from a scientific point of view, so utterly unnecessary." Fairchild's sadness, brought on by his own loneliness as he watched his work slowly drowning in Washington bureaucracy, prevented him from comprehending what had happened to Meyer. Every bit of evidence pointed to Meyer's suicide, to a man unequipped to silence the demons brought on by war and suffering. But Fairchild, either in denial or blinded by his own angst, wondered if what killed Meyer was vertigo or another nervous reaction. Could he have fallen over the rail? Was he pushed? For the rest of Fairchild's life, he considered Meyer's death a mystery. Fairchild held a memorial for Meyer at his house in Maryland, where the staff somberly celebrated Meyer's work with stories and photographs of his plant conquests. Fairchild paid tribute to the man whose plants would forever be growing on American soil, in mountains, in fields, in backyards, and orchards of little cottages. "Wherever they are," Fairchild said, "they will all be his." In his will, Meyer left $1,000 to the department, to be divided among the 100 men he had worked with. The men might have each taken $10, but they agreed unanimously to create a medal in his honor. The Meyer Medal would be awarded annually for virtuous acts of plant introduction. That Meyer had given his life to introduce plants set a high bar for anyone qualified for this honor. But Fairchild could think of one. A man who had encouraged the work of plant hunting, who gave years of his life and thousands of dollars to the only work he ever found fulfilling, useful, and important. In 1920, Fairchild saw to it that the medal's first recipient would be Barbara Lathrop. Chapter 20. Visayn Amerikanen. The bird squawked and squealed, writhing with wild insanity. It was caged, its wings clipped, its hunting prevented by its confinement. The bird was a monkey-eating eagle, named literally for its most noteworthy skill, and Fairchild watched the animal struggle against the metal wires. Fairchild had escaped the dining room of the hotel to stare at the bird, its delicate gray feathers in contrast to the fury on its face. His boyhood fascination with wild things was now accompanied by the patience of an older man. It was 1940. He was 70, and he was in the Philippines. For at least an hour, he had nowhere to be. After the war ended in 1918, David Fairchild mostly gave up. He was calm and composed, with the self-awareness to recognize that he had been pushed ceaselessly back. Meyer's death had hamstrung Fairchild's efforts to introduce novel plants, and as the war ended, tired Americans had little appetite and even less money for the program to rev up again. The popular plant immigrant bulletin that once circulated to farmers and nurserymen around the country was terminated. David Houston, the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, also instituted a new regulation, Quarantine No. 37, which ended all private importations of plants and bulbs. The department was exempted from this provision, but it tarnished the reputation of Fairchild's office as a source not of valuable material, but of ominous disease. Confrontations with Marlott had cooled, but the radioactive embers of earlier battles were slow to decay. Any chance that Fairchild and his childhood friend would reunite and chalk up their squabbles to the fog of impending war vaporized in 1921. Still not satisfied with the laws he helped engineer, Marlott took to the pages of National Geographic again to celebrate his success, penning a rhetorical victory dance. His claim that quarantine measures had kept out hundreds of pests was built on data that was impossible to confirm, but it stood to reason that diligently inspecting rootstock would occasionally uncover invaders. He relegated the honest disagreement with Fairchild to a place beneath the intelligence of the American people. If the average American knew as much of plant diseases as he does of human and animal diseases, the necessity of a quarantine against infected plants would not need to be sustained by argument, he wrote. Fairchild might have responded, but he was tired and decided not to. He thought it'd be a better use of time to give his son, Graham, age 15, the most tremendous of all experiences, a visit to a tropical jungle. So he took him to Panama. As the seed collection program deflated, the part of post-war Washington that most irked William Popenoe wasn't the heated rhetoric, but the budget. In 1919 and 1920, he watched his commissions dwindle. Fairchild tried to keep the office afloat by trying out new explorers, but none proved qualified for such fraught work. The new explorers spent lavishly and regularly requested new commissions for greater and greater sums. Popenoe finally had enough in 1925. He traded plant hunting for easier money, and more of it, and took a job as chief agronomist for the United Fruit Company, a corporation growing in value and prestige. Not long after he turned 31, Popenoe signaled to Fairchild in the subtlest way possible that he wanted to resign. He met a smart and pretty bamboo researcher, and he married her. Fairchild attempted to halt the losses, to reduce the office's expenses, and to convince Popenoe to stay. Still, Fairchild's efforts amounted to one man trying to change the currents of the Atlantic. In 1923, for the second time in Fairchild's life, a wealthy man, this time one named Allison Armour, asked if Fairchild would consult on a series of expeditions to collect plants around the world for private buyers. Fairchild accepted. Just as he had done in 1898, he explained to the Secretary of Agriculture that he needed to leave the program he had created. He told his staff, and himself, that he'd be gone just a short while. But this time, he didn't go back. One thing that made private life more palatable for Fairchild was that he and Marion had begun to escape more often to Florida. The swampy mess Henry Flagler once imagined a future metropolis was expanding, its population booming 50% in the 7 years after the war. New economic growth left people with more money, along with paid vacations, retirement pensions, and automobiles, which turned Florida into an attractive place to vacation. Not long after the war, the state repealed income and inheritance taxes, which brought even more people and money south. Property values boomed. People even bought land underwater in hopes that landfilling would turn it into beachfront property. The 20s would be a time when Americans judged one another by what they owned, and Florida became a new frontier for status and luxury. The Fairchilds weren't drawn to Florida's vogue. They liked the weather, the calm, and most of all, its tropical breezes. Only in Florida can an American feel the warm sun and midday rains and be surrounded by the crawling vines and towering palms that Fairchild loved in Java. Only in Florida can an American feel as if he actually lived in the tropics. So, in 1916, when the Fairchilds came across a piece of land in Coconut Grove next to the lapping waters of Biscayne Bay, they bought it. On his first visit, Barbara Lathrop named the house the Kampong, the Malay term for a family compound. Lathrop had ceased his overseas travel in the early 20s, his health failing and arthritis flaring. The steamships of earlier days were replaced with private cars which shuttled him from San Francisco to Chicago and Florida, where he stopped to visit friends or to convalesce from bouts of bronchitis or laryngitis in hospitals. Fairchild often hosted Lathrop at the Campong, along with the Bells and their scientific friends Thomas Edison and Harvey Firestone, who sought Fairchild's opinion on matters of botany and chemistry. Firestone, a tire magnate, was especially interested in growing rubber trees. To Edison, Fairchild told the story of the inn owner in Bangkok who left his electric chandelier burning all night. It's hard to imagine that the investment Lathrop made in Fairchild could have yielded any greater return than seeing his protege visited and consulted by the era's most renowned scientific minds. After a lifetime of moving, Lathrop, nearly 80, logged his last steps into a Philadelphia hospital room. Fairchild was in Europe when he heard the news, heartbroken not to have been at Lathrop's bedside on May 17, 1927, the day the old man expired. His remaining wealth had secured him a plot in a cemetery on the outskirts of Philadelphia, but his having no direct descendants, along with his lifelong disinterest in writing much down, allowed death to sweep away much of the story of his extraordinary life. Fairchild was left the primary steward of Lathrop's legacy. He described their 33-year friendship, highlighted by 8 years of travel together, as an intimate comradeship and the major romance in the story of my life. No one, not even Lathrop, truly knew how many times he had actually circled the world. One obituary would say 13, another 25. Lathrop told people 83. Fairchild filled his own advancing age with the same curiosity of his youth. His blue eyes sparkle with a deep, unquenchable interest and enthusiasm for all things, a pair of friends observed of him. He would pepper his grandchildren with questions, particularly during long drives he and Marion would make from Miami to Nova Scotia, where they built a summer house of their own at Bainbridge. "What's the most interesting thing you learned today?" Fairchild would ask. He was known to offer a quarter to any youngster who could conduct an interview with a stranger and return with a previously unknown tidbit. He advised, "If you can't be useful to someone, or they can't be useful to you, move on." The voyage that Fairchild would recount most to his grandchildren wasn't his first crossing of the Atlantic, or his adventure in Corsica. By the time his kids had kids of their own, Fairchild's first sighting of Java and his visits to the Kingdom of Hawaii seemed to have occurred in another life. His favorite trip of his life, he would tell them, was an expedition to the Malay Islands with Marion and a group of their friends. It was luxury travel aboard a private yacht, as Fairchild had been accustomed to with Lathrop, and its pace was sufficiently slow for a man in the sunset of his life. The trip, in 1940, was part adventure, part philanthropy. A wealthy accountant, Robert Montgomery, had offered to donate land in South Florida, as much as 83 acres, to create America's first botanical garden devoted solely to the flowers, vines, and fruits of the tropics. It was the kind of place Fairchild had visited in Boitensorg, Tokyo, and Rio de Janeiro. Fairchild resisted when Montgomery wanted to call it the Fairchild Tropical Garden, but when someone pointed out that no one alive was a more qualified authority on tropical botany, he relented. Having a garden required filling it. An aging Fairchild might have sent other people to collect, younger enthusiasts to travel on a private research mission to build this biological museum south of Miami. But once more in his life, Fairchild had the itch to leave the confines of land and see the illustrious Malay archipelago. Alfred Russel Wallace, now long dead, had lit in Fairchild a lasting spark that endured like the brightness of the equatorial sun. The world was again at war, again spurred by the Germans, and again threatening to engulf the planet. The aftermath of the Great War had led to another Great War, particularly because Germany left the First War humbled. In a treaty signed at Versailles, German leaders were forced to admit fault, relinquish some land, and pay war debts. This was, in a nationalistic sense, humiliating. A German veteran of the war built on this vulnerability a campaign to be chancellor, giving well-attended speeches about how Germany should march forward defiantly. He won office by vowing to restore Germany to its former greatness and purity. Germany's hubris didn't threaten an expedition in the Malay Islands. Holland, which still had legal ownership of the Indies, declared itself neutral in 1939, just as it had done in the First World War. And the Philippines were still, technically, American. The bigger threats were from Japan and China, at war since 1937 over land and labor. Japan had become richer and stronger, a combination that fueled its own imperial lust. But Fairchild deemed the risk worth taking. He knew his own expiration loomed. "Besides," he would write, "in our philosophy, dangers to health lurk everywhere, and the majority of folks seem to die in their own houses of some accident, perhaps from slipping on the bathroom mat, or from contracting some one of the diseases which spread through civilized society, possibly even faster than through the scattered societies of the more primitive world." In his lifetime, he had seen humanity become more guarded, more filled with fear, and more prone to war. And so there was, at any moment, no safer time than the present. He and Marion left for Los Angeles on a train much faster than those of the 1890s. Ocean travel had advanced too, although it was now becoming antiquated. People confident enough to fly in metal airplanes would cross oceans not in weeks, but in hours. Seeds no longer had to be stripped of moisture or shipped in potatoes. They could be carried as cargo through the air, resting on nothing but damp peat. Even the inspection process had been streamlined. Officials inspected plants at seaports and airports, bypassing Washington completely. A typhoon hit their ship heading across the Pacific, rocking their boat so ferociously that chairs in the dining room fell over, emptying their occupants on the floor. Marion wrote to her three children describing how surprised she was at the dangers of their voyage. "Two or three times a wave hit the boat with such a stunning blow that my heart missed a beat or two." Fairchild tried to distract everyone by telling funny stories. The ship for the voyage through the Java Sea was called the Chang Ho. It was a junk, an ancient Chinese-style sailing ship custom-built in Hong Kong for the expedition. The ship was decorated in classic Chinese style with hand-carved porcelain, a glowing sun, phoenixes, and dragons over the portholes. This time, the person who underwrote Fairchild's expedition wasn't a man, but a woman, Anne Archbold, the heiress of John D. Archbold, who had helped start Standard Oil. Archbold offered to cover every expense. All the Fairchilds had to do was meet her in the Philippines. America had granted the Philippine Islands a measure of independence in 1935, which began its decade-long march toward full sovereignty. Long after his earlier visits, when Fairchild wondered if botany could cure the fierce antagonism between Americans and the islanders, Manila had become a quiet but functional town where automobiles brought people to jewelry stores and movie theaters. So, it was in the small town of Davao, not long after the expedition got underway, that Fairchild gawked at the eagle in the cage. While he watched its struggles, he may have considered how lucky he was to find himself again in the Indian Ocean, so many years after his first visit and still with the strength for a new adventure. He might have thought about all the wealthy benefactors he had found to fund his exploits, nearly all through happenstance meetings that yielded thrilling opportunities. He could have fixated on the notion that, amid a constantly shrinking and interconnected globe, there still remained plants undiscovered by the Western world. But, most likely, even for an old man who had seen so much, an eagle that ate monkeys proved, yet again, the bizarre wonder of the tropics. The Chang Ho stopped in Sangye, on an island a dozen miles wide, with a 4,000-foot volcano rising above the clouds. Children who may never have seen visitors squealed as they surrounded Marion and other members of the party. Fairchild wandered off to botanize, as he called it, to collect palms. The Malay he had learned in Java had rusted by now. With hand gestures and props from the boat, he convinced the islanders to show him their rarest palms, one deep red and another with a spineless trunk. He studied mangroves along the shore, their roots stretching to reach muddy soil. He watched a colony of weaver ants secrete silk from their glands, and then pass it around to form a nest stronger than a man's hands could rip. More children, singing and chanting at the tops of their voices, awaited their boat as it pulled into Siau. The island was still smoking from an eruption and leaned to one side. 40 kids followed Fairchild as he collected seeds from one tree and shrub after another. He met the chief of the island, joyful at being called upon by an American. When the chief ate leaves of the papaya plant, Fairchild asked if he could take the chief's picture when he was mid-bite. If people at home learned that faraway people ate papaya leaves, later shown to balance blood sugar, boost immunity, and even weaken cancer cells, They might try them too. His cynicism about people's stubborn tastes had grown strong. I know there are many people who will shy at the idea of even tasting the leaves of the papaya, Fairchild wrote of the encounter, but as they shake their heads, they will reach for a cigarette. Aside from the plant hunting, which continued at Fairchild's now leisurely pace, the high point of the trip was when someone brought a coconut crab on board, alive with great weight. The women shrieked as Fairchild and the crew tried to train it backward into a jar. The animal complied, but only after its powerful pincers broke a mop handle in two. To preserve the creature, Fairchild filled a jar with formaldehyde. The low point would come several months later when Ned Beckwith, the expedition's photographer, was arrested, suspected of spying, perhaps for the Germans or working for the Chinese, since the Chang Ho had all the appearances of a Chinese boat. Dutch soldiers confiscated his camera and inspected his film. "Wij zijn Amerikanen," Fairchild insisted when he rescued Ned from the lockup. "We are Americans." A cablegram from the Dutch East Indies capital, Batavia, confirmed this, and Ned's captors allowed them to leave. The expedition was supposed to last 2 years, but suspicion, danger, and animosity would cut it short. Holland wanted no part in a Second World War, but after Germany invaded the Netherlands in May of 1940, Dutch soldiers feared the Germans would invade the East Indies next, so they began rounding up any Germans on the islands. They minded little about collateral damage, about apprehending a group of touring Americans hunting for, of all things, plants. As a courtesy, the Chang Ho was ordered to leave the region, to return to the Philippines, and then America. "Don't stop," Dutch authorities warned, "and don't look back." David Fairchild defied the order. The boat stopped at 17 more islands, and on each one he shuffled slowly onto shore to snatch seeds of palms, fruits, and flowers. He moved as fast as his aging body would allow to evade arrest, yet was content to be moved by the currents. He instructed the captain of the Chang Ho that they would take their time. Epilogue. One day, a few autumns ago, after several months of research, I decided it was time to meet David Fairchild. He'd been dead for 60 years, so I was really going to see the remnants of his work. Fairchild took his last breath under a Javanese ficus tree in his Florida garden one day in August of 1954, which seemed fitting for a man who had fallen so deeply in love with the tropics. The better part of a century later, there's a small army of people near Miami committed to keeping Fairchild's legacy alive. Gardeners, archivists, geneticists, all of whom draw a paycheck from a non-profit or government agency that wouldn't exist had Fairchild not lived. I spent days in a small room with taupe tile and a buzzing wall unit air conditioner, where boxes of Fairchild's old letters were stacked to the ceiling. I visited the Kampong, the house that he and Marion had lived in, and stood in their bedroom, hoping to discover what? I didn't know. I imagined Fairchild walking down the stairs and across a small breezeway to the kitchen, still with its original tile, and then I strolled out in his lush green backyard, now a venue for Miami weddings, and stopped to look at the view of Biscayne Bay that Fairchild enjoyed in the phase of his life when he simply sat and watched the lapping waves. Somehow, though, I didn't feel as if I had truly met Fairchild until I met Mike Winterstein. He asked me to meet him a few miles from the Kampong near an area blocked by a gate. About 5.5 feet tall, Winterstein was the kind of USDA employee I had never seen in Washington. His bronze skin and calloused hands made me think he probably hadn't put on a suit since sometime in the 70s. He talked fast and breathless, and when he heard I was poking around, he invited me to see the restricted USDA land where some of Fairchild's old plants still grow. "I'll take you for a drive around the property," he said. "You can see what it looked like when the man was here." We whirled around the orchard, taking such fast and sharp turns that it felt as if two wheels of our golf cart came off the ground. Twice, I reminded Mike, I wasn't in a rush. Twice he assured me that he wasn't either. He pointed to trees planted in the middle of tall, thick grass. Most of them were mangoes. Each started as a sapling that Fairchild picked up in some corner of the world. Now some were more than 50 feet tall. I couldn't resist asking Winterstein what was the purpose of keeping alive such old trees when more contemporary mango trees now exist, the fruit's production long ago outsourced abroad. Mangoes that once grew abundantly in Florida are now produced commercially in Mexico, Brazil, and India. And the avocados that helped build Southern California are now imported mostly from Mexico. These are the originals, Winterstein said, or in other words, the primary colors. By now, Fairchild's dates from Baghdad in 1903 have been mixed, crossbred, and hybridized millions of times, resulting in the dates in any American supermarket. Winterstein told me how chemists and fruit researchers still use the remnants of Fairchild's old work with mangoes, and, in a nice twist of diplomatic karma, it's often foreign researchers who find the most value in the mangoes Fairchild brought to America from other countries. Winterstein explained, "If Israel, for example, is dealing with a pathogen in their commercial mango groves, we can send them clean material to use for evaluation plantings." All of which makes Fairchild something of an originator. He could take credit for today's dates and avocados the same way Alexander Graham Bell could claim credit for the iPhone, or Henry Ford for a Ferrari. One person makes a breakthrough, and then innovators make improvements. Once I had this in mind, I started seeing Fairchild everywhere. On a trip to New York, I saw an ad on the subway for a drink called Peachy Keen Nectarine, with real fruit flavor. A high-end restaurant on Washington, D.C.'s 14th Street featured a Meyer lemon salad. In the mornings, I often run around the tidal basin near the Washington Monument. It's silent most days, except during a two-week period each spring when crowds fill the area, kites fill the sky, and a man with a cart sells cherry blossom ice cream. Fairchild's legacy seemed to have tentacles everywhere, and after a while, my friends grew to expect it. When I'd stab some food item on my plate, a cashew, some kale, a nectarine, and say, "Guess who helped bring this to America?" they were at first impressed, but over time, they began to roll their eyes. But Fairchild's successes are only part of his legacy. He often explained to people that food introduction had two phases, bringing a food across an ocean, and then getting consumers to like it. The second phase was where thousands of crops fell apart. Things like the vegetable pear, also known as the chayote, just petered out, uninteresting to farmers and eaters. Same story with dasheens, uncharismatic root vegetables that couldn't edge out potatoes, carrots, or even jicama for meaningful market share. I spent months trying to find a mangosteen, the fruit of Southeast Asia that Fairchild considered his favorite. He was perplexed by why people didn't see the magic he did, and disappointed until the day he died that mangosteens never caught on. Then, one summer day, my neighbor Wendy returned from New York with a grin. "I found some," was all she said. There in her kitchen, I tried for the first time the round purple fruit. After one bite, I understood why the mangosteen fizzled. It was delicious, sweet and creamy, but not cut out for long-distance travel. Its rind was too thick, its flesh too mealy, and it bruised too easily. When compared to today's powerhouse crops like bananas, apples, and oranges, mangosteens have a weak resume. Too bad, really. Selecting which fruits live and die based on their market appeal seems to be a form of bioeconomic Darwinism. But that's how agriculture works, and it has continued long after Fairchild's era. 100 years ago, American farmers grew 408 types of commercial tomatoes. Now the number has winnowed to 79, and 207 varieties of corn have become 12. Growing single crops at industrial scale ensures reliable food, but it also brings a greater chance of plant disease, and, if we're being sentimental about it, just a loss of richness about the world. Which returns me to the question I posed earlier, about whether there's room in today's world for another Fairchild. In all reality, the answer is probably no. The possibility of another food explorer leading an illustrious life seems to have been wiped away by the conveniences of globalization. Farmers now share crops, seeds, and tips at international conferences. I can take a webinar on how to grow the world's best rice and then buy seeds online. Keeping agricultural secrets is hard. A humble man stumbling on a new food that can reinvigorate America is nearly impossible in a world of multinational food companies whose jurisdiction is the entire planet. As with kale or quinoa, modern culinary spikes are usually the work of marketers, not explorers. But it'd be hard to argue that the way we do food now isn't overall a good thing. And on this point, I began to think that Fairchild would agree. I ended my search for Fairchild's legacy on Okinawa, the small Japanese island near where Fairchild first saw the cherry blossom trees he'd eventually bring to Washington, D.C. On my daily walks around my neighborhood, I passed a house that had a tree with perfectly pink cherry blossoms that, thanks to the temperate island weather, slowly opened over the course of my stay. I figured it'd be nice to have those back home, or at least to give to some friends. So I decided I'd engage in the same sort of botanical espionage that Fairchild pioneered. I probably could have just asked the owner of the tree if I could take a small cutting, and she probably, out of sheer bewilderment, would have said yes. But I decided to do the most un-Japanese thing imaginable and steal them instead, if only to feel the adrenaline one time that Fairchild must have felt hundreds. I procrastinated as long as possible until the morning of my flight back to Washington. When I walked down the road with a pair of scissors, the woman who owned the tree was pruning her garden. I hadn't accounted for this, so I made two laps of the neighborhood while I considered my strategy. I lurked around the corner until I saw her disappear from view to the other side of the yard. Then I walked briskly toward the tree. I slowed only slightly, and in one smooth arm motion, I cut three bud sticks from her cherry blossom tree, stuffed them in my pocket, and kept walking. They made their way back to Washington in my suitcase, sealed in a plastic bag with wet paper towels, the closest I could come to Fairchild's method of using damp moss. 40 hours later, lightning fast by any 19th century standard, I had them in my kitchen. I dipped each cutting in a rooting hormone I kept on hand for botanical emergencies, and then stuffed each cutting in a raw potato. I felt satisfied that I had done everything right, and had benefited from modern travel and climate control. Fairchild would be impressed. And yet, 2 weeks later, right as the buds might have grown new roots, when I might feel the triumph of successfully moving plant material from one continent to another, the cuttings began to dry out, the blossoms began to flake, and eventually, the flakes fell off. I'm no botanist, so perhaps my failure could be excused. But the whole exercise seemed to accentuate the accomplishments of a man who did this work a century prior, without the conveniences of modern life. There's now about as much life in the cuttings as there is on the moon, but I can't muster the courage to throw them away. I don't like looking at dead sticks any more than I like ending this book talking about them. But each morning, when I eat breakfast next to them, I sense something poetic that Fairchild might have felt. Botany is sometimes the disappointment of dead sticks. And sometimes, if you're lucky, it's the art of life, growth, and transformation. This is Daniel Stone. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Food Explorer, The True Adventures of the Globe-Trotting Botanist Who Transformed What America Eats. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn, executive producer Janet Stark. Text copyright 2018 by Daniel Stone, production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House LLC, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.